Hare Krishna. So, cell phones, cell babies. So we'll begin. Again, we're trying to understand one line from the Upadeshamrita, text 4. Is that all right? What's that? The one? By saying you're full with your feast? So, again, the verse, I'll read the verse again, we'll read more of Prabhupada's purport, and then try to understand this. The verse is Dadati, which literally means he, she, or it. Well, in this case, he or she gives, pratigranati, and takes in return. One gives, one takes in return. That's literally what it says. Guyamakyati, one explains a secret. Prichati, one inquires. Bhunte, one eats. Bhojite chaiva, one gives to someone else to eat. Shadvidang priti lakshanam. These are, this is the symptom of love, the sixfold symptom of love. Shadvidam priti lakshanam. Prabhupada, as we read last night, stated that even in ordinary activities, these six types of dealings between loving friends are absolutely necessary. Prabhupada said that ISKCON has been established to facilitate these six kinds of loving exchanges between devotees, and that people must be given the chance to associate with the devotees of Krishna, because simply by reciprocating in the six ways mentioned above, an ordinary man can fully revive his dormant Krishna consciousness. So these methods are very important. And Prabhupada goes on to explain that, for example, chanting Hare Krishna is a loving exchange, revealing something to people, that people need to give up non-devotee association and associate with devotees. Prabhupada says, if the members of human society actually want peace of mind, tranquility, and friendly relations between men and nations, they must follow the Krishna conscious system of religion by which they can develop their dormant love for Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, Prabhupada says we should avoid the Mayavadis. We don't particularly want to have Mayavadis reveal their minds to us. Well, unless they want to talk about it, but if they just want to try to persuade us, then that's not exactly the reciprocation we're looking for. Although we certainly wish them well, and we are willing to sell them some of our fine spiritual products and services, also available on ISKCON websites. Then, Prabhupada summarizes this whole discussion by saying, the conclusion is that we should always keep company with devotees, observe the regulative devotional principles, follow in the footsteps of the acharyas, and in full obedience, carry out the orders of the spiritual master. In this way, we shall be able to develop our devotional service and dormant Krishna consciousness. The devotee who is neither a neophyte nor a Mahabhagavat, a greatly advanced devotee, but is within the middle status of devotional service, is expected to love the Supreme Personality of Godhead, make friends with devotees, show favor to the ignorant, and reject the jealous and demoniac. So if your wife or husband is jealous, you have... Anyway, I'm just kidding. This means, of course, those who are very strongly jealous of Krishna. Other forms of jealousy may sometimes be tolerated. So, in this verse, there is brief mention of the process of making loving transactions with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and making friends with the devotees. So, these reciprocations even apply to Krishna. We offer Krishna food, and Krishna, to this day, has always offered it back. So, what if offerings start disappearing on the altars? Anyway, but that hasn't happened. So Krishna himself reciprocates. According to the Dadati principle, an advanced devotee is supposed to spend at least 50% of his income on the service of the Lord and his devotees. Sri Rupa Goswami has set such an example in life. When he decided to retire, he distributed 50% of his life's earnings to Krishna service, 25% to his relatives, and kept 25% for personal emergencies. This example should be followed by all devotees. Whatever one's income, 50% should be spent on behalf of Krishna and his devotees, and this will fulfill the demands of Dadati. So you could fulfill this Dadati requirement by going bankrupt. I'm joking, actually, but what Prabhupada says is we should follow Rupa Goswami's example. So Rupa Goswami's example is that when you retire, this is good news for the grihastas, you will all be jubilant to hear this. And if you are grateful for this revelation, remember me at the end of the year when you do your financial return. So, what Rupa Goswami's example is, of course, is that when you retire, then you should take all of your assets and give 50% to a Hare Krishna project, which is not likely to collapse in your lifetime, so that you won't be frustrated. And then 25% for your relatives, who I'm sure will be very pleased to see that they're getting only a fourth of your estate. And then a fourth you get to keep. It's interesting. Fourth for all the relatives and a fourth for yourself. This is certainly, there's no shyness here about individual self-interest. So of course, fortunately, we can, I mean, in spirit, we certainly have to follow this, and of course, regarding the details, everyone is free to seek a lawyer and work it out in some practical way. Anyway, So, this principle, Dadati Pratigarnati, Prabhupada says here that in full obedience, we should always, in full obedience, carry out the orders of the spiritual master. So I thought I'd tell you what it's like here from the cockpit. They have large numbers of fully obedient disciples. I would like to tell you that, but I haven't had that experience yet. So. And so actually, this since this Dadati Pratigranati principle is really essential for our spiritual life, we really need to do this. We really need to develop these kinds of relationships where we give gifts and accept gifts in return, and we allow devotees to feed us according to our dietary and medical requirements, and also feed them. Actually, I wonder if ISKCON is, we should probably hold the first international cholesterol competition. And there's a way we could probably get some media attention and show that this movement is able to compete on an international basis. Anyway, among these reciprocations, the one we're especially focusing on is Dadati Priti, Guhyamakyati Prichati. And Prabhupada does talk about the guru-disciple relationship as an example of this. So, I would like to bring up a few points, somewhat just slightly controversial, and you're free to take these controversial points and use them in your next rap song. So, but you have to mention me in the song to make credit for this. And that is, we know in the real world, which we occasionally are in the real world, that sometimes spiritual authority figures have given instructions to their dependents and followers, and it didn't quite work out. For example, insisting that you need to marry this person, you need to not marry that person, or you need to pursue this vocation or something, and at times it actually didn't work out well. And there was trouble and so on. So what about this? I mean, is anyone... We have to simulate these little, just mild electric shocks that you can strap onto your child during the class. Cause no permanent harm. Yeah, or pacifiers. So, I mean, so in terms of the guru-disciple relationship, also we've had the experience in ISKCON that some gurus have had difficulty. Some people have occupied the position of guru and then had some difficulty. Sometimes those who had difficulty on their way down emitted a series of somewhat eccentric instructions. So how do we really approach this? What about, for example, husbands and wives? In ISKCON we have, or we used to have, a hierarchy, and ultimately, the movement is not based on, well, let me put it this way, cup is half full. Ultimately, the movement is based on the understanding that there is a God, Krishna, and that Krishna is the highest authority. Can we help you? Krishna is the highest authority, and there are people who represent Krishna. So if you take Krishna seriously, if you take God seriously, and if you believe that someone is representing God, then it becomes a very serious relationship. Parents represent Krishna to their children. Devotees that go out to preach represent Krishna to the public. And gurus represent Krishna to their disciples. And so on. more advanced devotees represent Krishna to less advanced devotees. So I'd like to discuss this point. Authority has been somewhat controversial in ISKCON. Who is actually an authority? To what degree should we obey authorities? And so on. So I thought I'd dwell on that. We talked about this in Mayapur, and I escaped with my life. So I guess my remarks weren't too outrageous. For example, one can ask, if someone is a pure devotee of Krishna, or if someone is an advanced devotee of Krishna, does this mean that that devotee is expert at everything from financial... Does that mean that... I wasn't serious about the electric shocks, but... So... Prabhupada quotes a particular verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita about 200 times, in the Veda, at least in the Veda base, from what we have in the Veda base. And the verse is, Jare Dako, whomever you meet, Tare Koho, tell that person Krishna Upadesh, Krishna's instructions, either by Krishna or instructions given by devotees of Krishna. And then, Amara Gyai Guru Hoy, by my order, become a guru and Tare Desh, save this land. So, Prabhupada mentions over and over and over again, dozens and dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of times, in his explanation of these verses, that it's not hard to become a guru. It is not difficult to become a guru, that one simply has to repeat what Krishna has said. So, in a sense, Prabhupada is demystifying the guru-disciple relationship. So you could say demythologizing it, demystifying it, and explaining it in very common sense terms. Now Krishna is certainly the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and as we know, when we begin to serve Krishna, when we begin to follow the devotees of Krishna, we all have experiences which can only be explained as spiritual experiences. It's not that Krishna consciousness can be reduced down to mundane psychology or sociology. All of us who are engaged in spiritual life have spiritual experiences. At the same time, our spiritual experiences should be understood through the eye of Shastra, or authoritative books about Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada emphasizes in his explanations of what it means to be a guru, what a guru is that it's not difficult, it's not a magical thing, it's actually quite simple based on one, the ability of the guru to repeat, to intelligently and accurately repeat authorized knowledge coming down in parampara. So then one could raise the question, if we're allowed to raise questions like this, at what point is a guru acting as a guru? In other words, if someone, let's say, is with relative or reasonable competence performing the duty of a guru, and this could be not only a Diksha guru, a Shiksha guru, Vartna Pradarshika guru, it could be a parent. If one with reasonable competence is performing this duty of a guru, does that mean that individual at every moment, in every situation, is acting on the absolute platform? In other words, let's say I'm driving with a disciple and there's a red light ahead of us and I say, don't slow down, the light will change. Is that actually coming from Krishna? Brahmacharya, don't answer that. Or, for example, if I give a disciple advice on financial planning, is it true? In other words, I won't keep asking these rhetorical questions. I will It is not my understanding, because I've never read it in any scripture, and Prabhupada never said it. It's not my understanding that if someone is acting as a bona fide representative of Krishna, that means automatically that everything that person says on any subject will be true. So, on the one hand, there's a certain etiquette, but on the other hand, there's a certain fact of the matter. In all Asian traditions, including Buddhism, they tell the story that if the guru tells you a snake is a rope or a rope is a snake, then the disciple accepts it. But then one could ask the question, if I tell a disciple that a rope is a snake, is the rope actually a snake? Do I have the power to, let's say it really is a rope. By dint of acting as a bona fide guru, does one have the power to change ropes into snakes? Daru, bring out the rope. I'm going to show you right now that in fact I do have that power. Daru, where's the rope? Well, never mind, I won't do it then. Or to change a snake into a rope and so on. So there's a principle of obedience, but my understanding of this situation, my understanding is that even in a guru-disciple relationship, a devotee has to maintain some level of personal integrity, intelligence, and responsibility for their life. For one thing, Prabhupada often tells us, or gives the example of Shukracharya, which literally in English means Professor White. Shukra means white, Shukra or Shukla. The R and the L in Sanskrit are almost interchangeable in many words. So Shukra actually means white, and by extension, it can mean semen. And Acharya means, it's like professor. So Professor White. Prabhupada always gives the example of how Bali rejected his guru because his guru gave a bad instruction. It was sort of the one strike, you're out policy. So it seems to me that there are two extremes. One extreme would be to train disciples to be suspicious, like whatever your guru says, stop, think, consult a friend. Ask the guru to blow up a balloon if the instruction seems a little strange, or to walk a straight line. Diksha, what is that? Diksha under the influencer. So it's not that we should train disciples to be suspicious and cynical, but at the same time, there is a certain level of personal responsibility. And there's another point regarding trust. That is, it seems to me that the duty of any leader, any person in a position of authority, and this is especially true for devotees, should be trying sincerely to elevate the people under him or her, not keep them down. In other words, as a guru with disciples, it seems to me that the first responsibility of every guru is to try to help and guide, encourage and empower the disciple to become an autonomous, mature, adult human being in Vaishnava, as opposed to, on ideological grounds, keeping an adult in a childlike situation, or trying to engender a childlike state of mind. So, any questions on these points? I mean, you can see where I'm going. Yes?
A little bit off the subject, but Maharaj, is there an example of a disciple, of a guru, bringing up a disciple and the disciple actually spiritually going beyond, I don't mean stepping on the guru, you know, like that, but just
becoming more advanced than the guru.
Yeah, right. And then the guru maybe hands him to a sitya or someone else to help him along the way.
What was the second part of the first statement?
That the guru hands off the disciple to a more advanced devotee, Shiksha Guru. Feeling that the disciples now come to a certain point of advancement. That's an interesting question. Nothing comes to mind immediately. It seems to me that a guru, if he or she is doing their job properly, will simply try to arrange whatever is best for the disciple, which may include instruction from a particular person. Yes?
What you're talking about, you know, this ability to question, or you know, even the attempt to question, it sort of requires or it implies the ability to think to begin with. And it seems like a lot of times people maybe surrender to a guru because they don't want to be bothered thinking, and they say, well, I'll just do what I'm told, and that way the responsibility for my own life is off me and I'm not accountable. Therefore, if I get a bad instruction and I follow it anyways, I'm not responsible, and I can blame the guru after he falls down.
Do people actually think that way?
Well, I've seen it happen. You know, you'll have a guru who's very, autocratic, and all the disciples are yes, yes, yes. And then after, you know, some gurus have fallen down, and the venom that comes out is like, he was this and he was that, and they were the ones who were the most, you know, obedient and slavishly, without thinking, just doing what the guru says. And yet when the guru has a problem later on, they turn around like dogs and attack.
I haven't had the pleasure of that experience.
Something to look forward
to. Okay, you mentioned the word autocrat.
What I'm really interested in is you have to be able to think to begin with.
Yes, I'm going to get around to that. Let me do this one first, Roger. As a bona fide guru, I can actually answer two questions simultaneously, speaking out of both sides of my mouth, but it might be confusing to ordinary people who are not bona fide gurus. So, just to answer that one question. It seems to me that, well, Prabhupada once wrote to me and said the guru is a spiritual father. Assuming, of course, the guru is male. I mean, female guru probably wouldn't be your spiritual father. But the idea here is that if you think about parenting, in any relationship of authority where someone is subordinate, someone is on top, the authority is not unnecessarily or excessively exercising that power. You only exercise authority to the minimum amount necessary to bring about a necessary good for the person under you. And if someone in a position of you're right on the margin there, kid. Does someone own this show? The judges will now hold up the numbers. So, to exercise authority beyond what a person... In other words, if I exercise authority, it's not because, well, the guru should act like God, or the guru should be the authority, therefore, in order to demonstrate my position, I should exercise authority. It seems to me that's getting everything backwards. One should exercise authority as a parent or as a guru or as whatever because it's actually needed, because the person actually needs it. And if you have the good fortune of having a child or a disciple that is mature and doesn't need to be micromanaged, then why would you do that? Why would you tell someone something, or why would you coerce someone into acting a certain way when they could actually do fine by themselves. It seems to me it's actually harmful to the person and retards their development rather than stimulating it. So, so if an authority exercises their authority only to, it seems to me the principle of minimal authority should be a rule, that I should tell someone what to do, well, as if I could still do that, but every time I say that I think like, come on, who are you kidding? But first of all, what are my actual areas of expertise? A spiritual master is supposed to be just that, a spiritual master, someone who is expert in the spiritual science. Now sometimes that, of course, obviously intersects our material life. Like, for example, the guru may feel that the disciple, let's say, is pursuing an occupation which is ruining their spiritual life. And it may not be good for the disciple. But again, even then, if we are treating, I think, as I said yesterday, it's not healthy to treat adults like children. I think it's just not a good idea. Now, spiritually, we are, you know, we're born at a certain point, and then we're like spiritual children. But even though we may be like spiritual children, someone may be materially an adult. And therefore, if the guru is speaking to a disciple about material affairs, and the person is a material adult, I think that person should not be treated like a material child. I think it's just artificial, and I think it's not part of the job description. So, and also it avoids embarrassing situations where someone in a position of authority just gets it wrong. If I'm simply speaking from Shastra, then I think I can really get it right. But if I'm speculating about financial planning, vocational counseling, marriages and things like that, Prabhupada, in the early days of the movement, was arranging marriages, but they kept turning out so badly that at one point, Prabhupada himself got burned out and wrote a letter to all the temple presidents. I was a temple president, said, basically, I've had it. You know, just you figure out who you want to marry. And so when Prabhupada saw the result, when Prabhupada first came, he converted some hippies and people who had pretty awful lifestyles in some ways. He had to teach them basic principles like hygiene and how to cook. And I think the result of that was we have this image in our mind that the guru has to sort of baby the disciple or tell the disciple everything. And some disciples may need that because they're materially dysfunctional. But if a disciple is not materially dysfunctional, it's a different relationship. So if you look at Prabhupada's relationship, for example, with people in India, his life members and some of the most important people in India, very wealthy people, very influential people, who were materially quite expert, quite mature, they were already middle-aged. And Prabhupada didn't like tell them how to clean themselves after they went to the bathroom. He actually treated them very much like adults. He would insist on the spiritual science, but in terms of their human relationship, he very much treated them like adults. And there was mutual respect in the relationship. In many ways, we sort of imitated Prabhupada. It's like children imitating the parents without real understanding. So I think in general, there are certain principles which ensure a healthy relationship in the case where someone's on top and someone's underneath. It's like the trial of Galileo. The church thought that because, you know, we are the vicars of Christ on earth, therefore we are expert at astronomy. It turned out not to be the case. And the church was very embarrassed. And I mean, here it is, like, I don't know, almost 500 years later, and everybody's still talking, yeah, did you hear about the trial of Galileo? It's this real black mark on the church. I mean, 500 years, almost a half a millennium later, people still remember the trial of Galileo as the great historical symbol of obscurantism, you know, spreading darkness throughout the world. So the church kind of backed out of astronomy at a certain point and left it to the astronomers. And so in the same way, I think that to treat adult disciples like children, even in material affairs, first of all, I think is unhealthy for the disciple and also will inevitably embarrass the guru. Yes, Harinam Ji. Imagine after the glorious Vedic revolution, the phone book, it's like there's only one last name, Ji. Or two last names, I guess, could be Doss and Dossie. We have to think of those things, like what to do with phone books after we take over the world. Go ahead.
It seems that when you were speaking about how the disciples were so young, there needs to be immediate understood principles that maybe early on they didn't. And so now we're coming to a place where we're demystifying that position and we're saying, okay, this is what Lord Chaitanya wanted. He wanted spiritual mentorship, basically, because it's a planet of 6 billion people who need help. So that all of us are being asked to take responsibility, and Lord Chaitanya is not saying, I need you to be perfect before you do anything, because otherwise nobody's going to get help. So we're understanding that. And we're seeing that one of the problems is that there are very absolute statements in our scriptures that we have misapplied. And so it seems that you're giving us maybe some ways to look at these absolute statements that are different than how we applied them in the past. And that seems to be one of the greatest difficulties we have, is trying to follow the scriptures and then apply them in our life in a realistic way. And that's difficult, you know, because there are statements that say that the guru is as good as God. There are statements that say, you know, he should be in this and this and this platform. So I would be interested, for example, in that particular statement that you know, the guru is worshipped as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's given all respect.
Very good. I should give you a chair too. The idea of Guru Devata, that the guru is a deity, again, you could raise a simple question. Does this apply to the guru when he's explicitly performing guru activities, teaching Krishna consciousness, or what about if he's just sort of commenting on World War II or talking about a cure for the common cold, or are those absolute statements, or should they be? Prabhupada indicated they're not, because Prabhupada indicated that I mean, that doesn't mean we should just be rude and disrespectful, and that, because sometimes a guru may actually say something right. I mean, it's happened. And you can actually give good advice to someone, which, of course, there's no advice which is too good to be ignored, as we know. So I think it's very important that gurus themselves, I think it's easy to follow these principles. If the gurus themselves have a mature understanding of what their responsibility is and what their area of competence is.
Is that something that's being clarified now with those who are having that position? So when people take that position, there's some understanding from those who have spent so many years in trial and error trying to arrive at the right place?
I've begun speaking on it. And since everyone at ISKCON always accepts everything I say, it shouldn't be long now before. It's just something that's concerned me. I don't want to abolish noble etiquette and culture because it's something which is very valuable. But what you said is very interesting. There is a fact that Western culture is in some ways significantly different from Eastern culture. Western people, for thousands of years actually, as far back as we have recorded history, there's been sort of a tension between East and West, in the sense the West tends to be a little more individualistic or rebellious and not to have the same, at all times, the same attitude toward authority. So we have certain statements about, as you said, guru-disciple relationship. And so how do we deal with that in the real world? So that it doesn't become, so on the one hand, we don't just ignore it and pretend those statements aren't there, but on the other hand, it doesn't just become sort of a hypocritical show. Like, you can get into that thing. There are gurus in ISKCON. Thanks for coming in that door. So, that's the Hare Krishna moment. So, there are gurus that just don't give that many instructions. They sort of accumulate disciples, and everyone knows they're not, like, you write a letter to the guru, probably won't answer anyway. And so it's kind of like safe. I think it would be better to do that in the back of the room. Yeah, so that way you'd have an escape plan. I mean, there are situations where sometimes a lot of etiquette is showed, great worship, and so on and so forth, many flower garlands, you know. Probably eventually have old gurus with neck problems, I think. But so you get like a lot of flower garlands, a lot of worship, but it's kind of like understood that the guru is not really going to tell me to do anything. And if the guru does give me a lot of instructions, you kind of like wiggle out of it and cry or say something. And so there's also a danger. There's always, in a religious society, there's always a danger of hypocrisy. Because the higher the principles are, the more likely it is people won't follow the principles. And so there's probably the greatest opportunity in any institution, the greatest opportunity for hypocrisy is in a religious institution. And so there's also this danger of sort of empty formality, so that we keep the shell of guru-disciple thing, but on the ground, people really do what they want. Or they may not even follow the etiquette, even outwardly. Or the other extreme, you may have a situation like some communities where cradle to grave, your life is strictly regulated. Like you said, you know, someone said you don't have to think, and you're told what to do and whom to marry, and everything is kind of like you. And so, I mean, there are some communities in ISKCON, frankly, where, I'm not talking about here, but there's, as you'll soon see, there are some communities where there's very strong leadership, and devotees who, let's say, are kind of creative or think for themselves gradually or quickly don't make it there, and so you gradually get a community with sort of, I don't want to say shudras, but people that are sort of just content to be work within a system, and it produces a certain efficiency. So then it gets into the issue of, you know, what do you do if you're a little creative? What do you do if you actually are a mature adult and you're in a situation where that's not okay? Because it may be, I mean, there are communities where really it's not appreciated if people think too much because there's one person who will think for everybody. there's all these different situations. There's all these different situations, and there's a tendency to play the card. Like one boy came to see me in Mayapur. He's from another country, and he was in a temple where he's not really happy because he's sent out just to sell things, to collect money, sort of like an eternal fundraising yatra. And he's a young man, and when he's not really happy with it, but when he talks to the temple president or even a visiting sannyasi guru, he's told that Krishna put you here, Krishna wants you to do this. And so there's this invoking of divine authority to support what may be my imperfect administrative decision, or the fact that I just have some cockeyed plan. Like, I want to get something done, and so I may intimidate the people under me, like, Krishna wants you to do this. And if you don't do this, you're rejecting Krishna. When in fact, it's really sort of my idea. So all these things, and then again, there are genuine, powerful guru-disciple relationships where the guru's actually representing Krishna. If you don't follow, then you're really not doing what Krishna wants, because in that particular case, the guru is successfully channeling the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it's really, I mean, it may seem like I'm just trying to prove that bhakti yoga is essentially impossible to practice, but the reason I'm bringing up these points, and of course many other points, is that I think that those of us in positions of leadership have to be very careful about pushing people around in the name of Krishna. And that we have to develop mature, intelligent relationships which are aimed at making people mature and intelligent. The purpose of a guru-disciple relationship is to make a disciple a mature, adult, autonomous Vaishnava. To keep someone dependent just because it feels good to have people hanging on me, or I just, you know, I love being able to just tell people what to do. That's one of the dangers. Lord Chaitanya says, Nadanam Janam. So everything that I do in relation to a disciple should have as its purpose helping that disciple become autonomous and mature so that that person can actually make intelligent decisions on their own. Otherwise, I'm sort of like purposely keeping a person beneath what they might be, holding them back just because I want followers, or I think that you should merely be a follower. I mean, I'm not suggesting that at a certain point you give up your guru, reject the guru, but we're grateful to Prabhupada precisely because he's setting us free. Prabhupada is giving us the path to freedom. Yes? Follow-up question.
So what you're speaking is good if you're, you know, I think everybody here would agree with that, but we're not in the position of guru. We're all in the position of following leaders. And we're having a really difficult time right now because of past history. And I think we're looking for some way to look at leaders, to have faith in them, even with fallibilities, and to find a way to be honoring of the etiquette and at the same time being thoughtful on our own. And I think we're struggling with that a bit. I think that's, you know, I know that here we're having a little trouble with trying to figure out leadership that we're willing to get behind, because almost we're thinking we don't want leaders that make mistakes, which really isn't very practical. So we're needing it from sort of our perspective.
Well, in a sense, it seems that in a sense, if there is a mistake, it should be the community's mistake, because a leader should be someone that sort of engages the community and helps to empower, you know, helps to, so that if we do things by consensus, I know I'm GBC in Atlanta, Georgia, which is just up the road there, a piece, and you're all welcome to come and engage our Hundi box. So, even though I'm the glorious GBC of that place, still, whenever we make important decisions, we all, I mean, at least among the senior devotees, we try to do it together. Because after all, it just seems to me that's the way we should operate. We should try to build consensus. We should try to do things together. We have, I made one more point, that Brahmatirtha can strongly support everything I've said. And that is that, well, go ahead, Brahmatirtha. To be honest and admit that we are works in progress. We are conditioned souls trying to become Krishna conscious. And that I remember being a young devotee and hearing that proverb, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and feeling very grateful that it didn't apply to the Hare Krishna movement. But I always tell this story. I remember the first time I was really given power in the Hare Krishna movement. And if any of you ever watched the Andy Griffith Show, where Barney Fife had like one bullet, and as soon as he took it out, he just like would fire it compulsively. And so the first time I was really given authority, I'd been in the movement about a month, and then two other guys joined. One was a hippie. I mean, we had to hire a U-Haul trailer to take his hair away after we shaved him up. So I was told to take these two guys, two young devotees, about 1.5 blocks down Durant Avenue, Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, to join the Harinam Sankirtan party, which was blanketing the community with incense fumes. And anyway, so that was my job. I had to go 1.5 blocks down the street with two new devotees. And I remember as we walked out the door of the temple and started going down the street, I basically went crazy. Because here I was representing Krishna. They were under my authority, and all the power of God, all the power of the absolute truth was pulsing through my body and coming out my effulgent lips. And as we started walking down the street, I literally started firing off instructions. I don't know. I mean, in retrospect, I can't imagine what I told them, but I was literally giving them a series of commands, like, I mean, I think they weren't walking properly or breathing properly or something. Because, I mean, what else could you tell someone when you're walking and blocking out that street? And at a certain point, they just said, like, they kind of protested, like, could you please stop? And I realized that I was, I'd really just gone crazy, because this absolute authority over other human beings. So it's that's why religious movements are the salvation of the world, and at the same time they're dangerous, because people, human beings, conditioned souls believe that they have absolute authority. And that if you are a conditioned soul, that can really kind of mess your head up a little bit. So. as you said, Ramachir, that people sort of like, you know, if you have to err on the heavy side, I think all of us who are in positions of leadership were affected by this. And one of the safeguards is, of course, now that we're older and we have all kinds of glass ceilings in ISKCON. So it's, I mean, in the old days, people at very young ages would get very big positions. And in a normal society, you would give those positions to older people. So I think another point, though, is that I think we need to develop a culture which is not so, forgive this term, fascist. In the sense that I'm not promoting anarchy here, or everyone go home and, you know, take out a picture of your guru and rip it up. I'm not promoting anarchy or rebellion. Just that I think that a sort of a tyrannical structure or culture, sort of banana republic dictators, it's not healthy for the people in leadership positions. It actually is not good for them. I think it's not healthy for the people under them. And it's an absolute disaster in terms of our preaching. So we do need authority, we do need leadership, but I think we really have to cultivate a leadership culture which is more than a mode of goodness. Great soul, Mahatmaji. Mahatma is actually one of the few living devotees from my neighborhood, which is a great distinction. I preached to Mahatma when he was just a when he was cleverly disguised as a fruitive worker. He's a student in Berkeley. I was the first student at Berkeley to join the Hare Krishna movement. And then I preached to him. I still remember preaching to him. And now here he is. that's actually the same sweatshirt he was wearing back then. Go ahead.
So I agree, let's say 99.9%. So I'm not actually playing the devil's advocate, but there's another point. What about the idea Bhaktivinoda Thakur says you have different gurus to satisfy the needs of different kinds of disciples. Some to mislead them, some more elevated gurus. So when we see all the distinctions that you're describing, does that play into it? And is that just inevitable?
Well, I don't think we should have inappropriate gurus on the grounds that Prabhupada built a house where everybody can live and some people really need inappropriate gurus. I think that would be a dangerous way to think about it. It is a fact, though. I mean, something you said is very true, and that is that some people feel comfortable, perhaps some people only feel comfortable if someone else is directing their life. So, at the same time, according to the principle of minimalism, if a disciple really needs help, like a disciple comes and says, I can't figure this out, I really need you to help me, please tell me what to do in this situation, then, you know, the guru, if it's really a case where the disciple is begging for that kind of assistance, then the guru may step in or may refer to the disciple to an expert. For example, if a disciple approaches me and has some kind of emotional problems, then it may be prudent and necessary to refer the disciple to a mental health professional who is, you know, sympathetic to Krishna consciousness. It seems to me that the guru, if I'm a guru, it doesn't mean that I always have to pretend that I have the answer. It should mean, or it may mean in many cases, that I refer a disciple to an appropriate expert in a field, whether it's financial, emotional, vocational, and so on.
The other side of the question, you were talking about what you consider a more healthy relationship and what would be unhealthy for certain groups, but it seems that everybody has their nature.
Mm-hmm.
So it, perhaps it's my nature. If I were to, I wouldn't want people overly dependent on me. Someone else may have a nature where they just want to be the boss.
Yeah, but true. But then we have to ask the question. If someone who is attached to, quote unquote, being the boss, is that person really ready to act as a guru? It seems to me Lord Chaitanya said the opposite. He said, I don't want to be the boss. Na dhanam, I don't want money. Well, allow me to interpret that. And for Krishna. But if the guru, I mean, to be, guru is not a position one should assume just to dovetail one's propensity to lord it over. I mean, some people, if someone really wants to lord it over and also really wants to spread Krishna consciousness, they can find their niche. They can find some people and they can dominate them and make them Krishna conscious, perhaps. But I think it's dangerous for someone to become a guru in order to dovetail their propensity to lord it over other people.
That being the case, it would seem then, therefore, we have to, everyone who wants to be a guru has to go
psychological testing.
He's this kind of personality. He's been, you know, his parents were like this. He's going to be just like his parents who were tyrants. Blah, blah, blah. We can't let him do it, although he can perfectly represent.
Well, people have track records. If someone is really advancing spiritually, they should be transcending at least the grosser manifestations of their conditioning. Perhaps because of my background and where and how I grew up, it has some effect on me. But if I'm advanced in Krishna consciousness, for the most part, I should be beyond that, and I should, or at least be able to make decisions and give instructions or advice in a professional way. For example, let's say someone's a competent airline pilot. They undoubtedly have a certain history, psychological history, emotional issues, whatever. But when the person gets into the cockpit and starts flying the plane, they just have to do their job right. They just have to do the job. I mean, this is someone's a brain surgeon that, you know, has emotional issues. But when you go into the, what do they call it? Surgery?
Operating theater.
Yeah, because they show all kinds of movies. So the doctor, you know, he's operating. So when they go into the operating theater, the doctors, they just have to do their job right. So there has to be a certain professionalism in the guru position, not only in the sense of happily accepting donations, you know, go professional. Like, sometimes that's what it means, takes in yas. Like, yeah, I've been an amateur preacher. I think I'm going professional now. So I don't just mean professional in that sense. But there has to be a certain professionalism. Like, whatever my childhood was, or whatever kind of mood I'm in, I have to do my job right. I have a certain job to do, and I have to do it properly. So if there's that professionalism, then that can allow someone, despite the inevitable imperfections we all have, allow someone to do their job properly. And go ahead, Mahatma. This is a multi-pronged question.
So, okay, I agree with that. But based on your previous statements that within our society we see that doesn't always exist, are we to assume those persons are not very Krishna conscious? Or can they exist simultaneously? One can be very Krishna conscious and very conditioned, and that condition just...
Where there's darkness, there is no light. Where there's light, no darkness. I mean, to say that someone is very Krishna conscious and very heavily conditioned.
In particular areas.
But I think people, but that's what culture is about. It compensates. Let's say, for example, I have a tendency to shout. But if I'm trained that it's impolite, that you shouldn't do it, or if I live in a place where, for example, Just to give a simple example. Because I spend a lot of time in Los Angeles where, like, when you drive your car through the city, it's kind of like going to war. And you... It's just incredible driving through, you know, driving through L.A. And so when I moved up to San Luis Obispo for a while, there's sort of this nice little mode of goodness, super civil town on the central coast of California. I remember when I got there the first week, I was behind someone and I honked my horn, and it's like everything stopped in the city. Don't tell that story, I'm not about to. Everything stopped in the city, and you know, people started looking at me like, what did you just do? And I realized, oh, I guess you don't honk your horn here. And I remember it took me like a month just to slow down, because I was like, you know, I was in this nice little city and everybody's peaceful and driving slowly, and I was driving as if I was in Los Angeles. So that's what culture is about. Good fences make good neighbors. There have to be cultural fences. We have to establish a culture where certain types of behavior is appropriate. And so, conditioned or not, there's just certain things you don't do and certain things you must do. That's the beauty of culture, especially Vedic culture, is that it allows everyone to act appropriately, even if inside they're weird. So that, for example, if everyone follows the rules, you'll have civil society. People may not all be civil, but if somehow they're trained to follow the rules, you will get civil society. Yes?
When is it appropriate, and how is it done? When you need to, or you feel you need to confront a guru.
Confront a guru.
Or challenge somebody on their position.
Okay, I'm ready. When is it appropriate?
How is it done? I mean...
How is it done? That's a good question.
Could I just say that in my lifetime, I've watched so many gurus fall by the wayside. And even as a 10-year-old, I saw some activities were inappropriate, and no men said anything, when dogs were marched through temple rooms and stuff. And...
You had the pleasure of living in West Virginia, I suppose.
No. But no one stood up, and I'm wondering... You say we need to change the culture within ISKCON, but how is that appropriately done? When is it okay to say this is not proper? And what I'm seeing here doesn't make sense, even to a 10-year-old kid.
Yeah. Well, I think... I don't know what it's like now. I mean, maybe it's... Like nowadays in ISKCON, maybe someone that... Would anyone here venture to describe... Of course, ISKCON is so diverse. There's so many different places. Like what it's like now. And people do, I think, speak out a little more now. But in answer to your question, like what should you do? I think that if you think that something is seriously inappropriate, dangerously inappropriate, that it's behavior... which is actually harmful. It's actually, which could cause significant harm to people. Then I think you have to, I would take it up in a discreet way, because if we are indiscreet, we actually lose control of the process. You know, you get a vigilante mob. It may turn out in some cases that I didn't understand things perfectly, or So I think there's something, discretion doesn't mean sweeping things under the rug. It doesn't mean just looking the other way. Discretion means that you act, but you're just, in a sense, through discretion, you keep control of the process. It doesn't just go wild. But yeah, I would start with people you trust that are either in positions of authority or who know people in positions of authority, and just start discreetly speaking about it and pursue it.
Could I bring up one more thing?
Sure. We are definitely entertaining multi-pronged questions tonight.
To me, just in what I see,
there's a lot of pain, like Karinam was alluding to, still existing within ISKCON. And in my opinion, it's a bit much, but it seems that if a lot of past things were acknowledged and apologized for, truly acknowledged, where people in leadership positions really took the time and energy to say, you know, I made a decision that heavily affected your life, and I want to apologize for it, it seems like that would change the culture in ISKCON. And until that's done, I don't understand how it can happen. And I'm asking, is there a way to do it without really acknowledging and apologizing for what happened in the past?
I mean, I agree with you that that's part of it. I agree with you, that's part of it. There's always a human tendency to want to save face. And, I mean, I've seen people, I suppose I've seen myself, and I've seen other people where you see something's wrong, and so you try to save face, but then you correct yourself. And, of course, sometimes that doesn't satisfy the people who are affected. So, I think you're right. I think you're right, and it's all part of a process, in the sense that the more we recognize what an appropriate authority culture would be in ISKCON, the easier it becomes to apologize, because you don't think like you're supposed to be on a pedestal. You don't have to be on it. You just have to do your job right. So in a sense, trying to create a more appropriate sense of what leadership and authority is in ISKCON makes it easier for people to admit that what was done wrong in the past. Leela Nanda.
There was an article in Fortune magazine about a year ago about apology. And the American society is so involved in litigation that many times when a leader apologizes, he can be involved in a lawsuit without knowing. So often leaders don't want to apologize, not because they don't feel
it's true. I'm not anti-apology, but I mean, I actually did have one experience with a disciple of mine, where I felt I had done something which wasn't right in the past, or given an improper instruction. So I apologized, and then this person actually got even more angry and said, "Well, if you're apologizing, it means that you admit you did something wrong, and if you did something wrong." And when I was a young devotee, I thought you couldn't do anything wrong, so that means you cheated me. I mean, it's not that I told these people that I can't do anything wrong. It was sort of a collective consciousness. So again, I'm not saying we shouldn't apologize. I'm just saying that sometimes it gets a little complicated. But in general, what you said is a very good idea. Maybe some of the ladies? Yes.
I have a question for you. Master, what you were saying yesterday about morality, you were sort of generally defining morality as good for people. And from my understanding of Western morality, there's basically the utilitarian approach with the Kantian and...
What was the second one?
Kantian.
Oh, Kant.
Kant,
yes.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm doing a course online. And virtue ethics. So... let's take an example. Say you've got a spiritual master-disciple relationship, and the spiritual master has a fall down and rectifies immediately, but doesn't tell his disciples. And his reasoning is, let's just say it's utilitarian, with the greatest good for the greatest amount of people. But maybe his path of thinking. Then you have a disciple who's more Kantian. Is like into absolutes, and this is, you know, categorical imperative, and this is wrong, and so number one and number two is wrong. I've been treated as mean. So that disciple disagrees, and in a case like that, does the disciple, because they're thinking in two different ways on morality, does the disciple have a, what would you say, the disciples for that, is it valid for the disciples to say, we just think differently on morality than I can accept?
good point. That was really a good point. Well, my thought would be this, that I think if we had a more human, more realistic sense of what a guru is, that it wouldn't be on the one hand so as cultish, and the other hand people wouldn't be so disappointed. In other words, you might be willing to allow a teacher sometimes to be a human. Of course, as we know, human being is a material dead bodily designation, but he gets into this fine line between bodily identification, just thinking, I am this body, I am a human being, which we're not supposed to do. And on the other hand, thinking that I'm a spirit soul, I'm part of Krishna, however, I am in a human body, I am coming from a background of bodily conditioning. I am sincerely trying to serve Krishna, but I still have this reality of a body and all the momentum of my past conditioning. So I'm serving Krishna at the same time having to deal with and my human condition. For example, we know we're not the body and yet we all eat food and sometimes even eat tasty food. So Prabhupada said that if you try to imitate Raghunath Das Goswami and just eat like two or three old rotten grains of rice a day, then you'll fall down. So there at times there's sort of like a myth. There's been like a mythological sense of guru, and that leads to great anger and bitterness if you feel I've been cheated because I was led to believe this. And it's like the bigger they are, the harder they fall. So, I mean, what you said was very, very good, that utilitarian ethics versus act-based or Kantian ethics, which also has a different name. So, I mean, the sense that because this person is a guru, it's like one false step and this person should be publicly humiliated. I mean, there's a sense in which I gave so much to this person, I thought so highly of this person, that there's this... Some people react differently. Some people, having once exalted someone or thought very highly of them, when the person has difficulty, actually react almost with a certain... you could say a heightened sense of sympathy, that because I value this person so much, or did value this person so much, therefore I feel greater sympathy to try to help this person or try to overlook this person's fault because I value them. So that's one way that in the real world some people react. And then you get a whole other group of people, also numerous, that react in the opposite way. It's almost like what I suspect is just trying to understand these two different reactions, that people who react with great anger and outrage and bitterness and I was cheated, I was led to believe in this person, it seems to me that there was something unhealthy about their original conception. Because if someone reacts with such anger and bitterness, I think there was just something unhealthy, something wrong about their original approach. It was somehow irrational. So, I mean, do you want to pursue the point?
Just not really. I just that wasn't really thinking to ask moral thinking person would be, you know, angry. But we just it's just their thought process was that was an immoral thing that was done. And it's not that they would be trying to have a war with the other person, but they think about morality, which is such a basis, as we were saying yesterday, so differently to they discover that now. Especially in this particular case, let's say, where it seems significant. intending not to say anything, and for a good reason. But yeah, it just seems such a different way of thinking that.
Interestingly, Krishna himself tends not to be a Kantian ethicist. Because Krishna tends to look at the consequences, if you look at various historical incidents in the life of Krishna. So, I mean, people react differently. But you brought up that's a very good distinction. Like in marriages, some marriages survive infidelity, some marriages don't. Some people, it's just like, that's it, it's over immediately. Other people have the power to forgive. So, it's like, you know, we talk about the power to forgive. Some people, it's just that they're so offended, they feel so strongly about these moral principles that they just absolutely cannot. I mean, in one sense, they can forgive. Like, I won't despise you for the rest of my life, but I can never again see you as an authority. I can never again respect you in that way. And they feel that even one moral slip is absolutely incompatible with a certain position. So I think you brought up a very good point that these are different psychological types in a sense, and people by their different psychologies are led to embrace different moral approaches, even if, like, most people don't know that there are different moral philosophies or they don't put a name on it, but they do sort of organize themselves into these different groups. That's very good. Another lady, and then we'll go back to the male-bodied devotees. First, a female-bodied devotee. Yes, you want to say something?
Maharaj, I don't understand why all the emphasis is put on the failure of the guru, for example, to instruct about other topics that are not Krishna consciousness. Because I have seen personally my spiritual master telling all the disciples that he's not giving conjugal advice. He doesn't want to be involved, he's a sannyasi, he doesn't have experience, but the disciples keep going to the guru with questions, my marriage, this problem, that problem. So it's also a responsibility of the disciple to approach the guru to learn how to serve Krishna better, instead of going with...
That may include practical things. So if the guru is able, I think it's okay to engage in a dialogue with the disciple, just, you know, sit down and talk about it like two adults. And if one of those people has, let's say, more Krishna consciousness, they can certainly, the spiritual insight is definitely useful. But I think in general, if there's mutual respect between gurus and disciples, and you treat adults like adults, which Prabhupada did, even with his own disciples, he treated adults like adults. I saw that. And then I think it's not so dangerous because you sort of talk about it. You work together to try to figure out what's best.
I was going to say that. In other things, Srila Prabhupada was giving medical advice. If one has experience like a friend, he can give something without being a doctor, you know. But another thing that is not so relevant in the context of this lecture, but you mentioned how some gurus have neck problems because of the garlands.
Oh, I was just...
Yes, I know. It was like an ironic remark, but I have seen... photos of Srila Prabhupada with so many garlands, because that is also a loving exchange between guru and disciple. It doesn't necessarily mean that if a guru uses the different maha garlands, he's like, oh, he's so proud, or, you know, I just wanted to clarify that from my humble point of view, because my Guru Maharaj uses many garlands. That's why I feel that they have to say, and he doesn't accept a boka garland. And it's a loving exchange.
Yes.
Like to give a garland to my guru, and I like that he uses at least for some time. He gives me a flower. It's a loving exchange. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, thank you for clarifying that.
It's not so important, but
I know. I don't. Your guru is definitely not simply a mundane garland monger. So you wanted to say something?
Yeah. Guru Seva, and you were talking about, I feel like my life for the past couple of years has epitomized that. And it brings to mind something else that because I went through an experience and I suffered greatly and I was very angry and I was trying to make sense, even though I never lashed out at the guru, I was trying to make sense of this and I could not find anywhere
somebody who could help me make sense of the whole tattva of guru disciple relationship. I got plenty of advice on etiquette and whatever, but not how one should really see. And I don't know if anybody has discussed this, but you know, reading Bhagavad Gita, I saw that the initial relationship between Krishna and Arjuna was one of friendship.
Yes.
And the initial relationship between Prabhupada and his first disciples, or somebody who would just come to visit him in his quarters, was one of friendship. And so it was almost like a relationship of equals, even though, and then out of recognizing the qualities of the person in this, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, it was Krishna, but it seems that all the people who remained in my life that I actually considered gurus were actually people such as yourself who approached me as a friend, and I approached them maybe with a little more respect, but it was more of a friendly relationship. And I don't see why that can't be a model instead of, it just seems to me to instantly assume the position of guru before you even know what your relationship with the person is about seems extremely artificial.
I think it's a good point. I saw Prabhupada in India where people were sort of, they were more natural in this culture. And often Prabhupada with his Indian disciples, especially the more educated ones, like Bhakti Charaswami, it was sort of like a family relationship. It wasn't like this big, majestic thing with thunder and lightning. It was just, I think every relationship, guru, disciple, whatever, has to be at a human level natural. Which is what you're saying. In other words, two people meet each other and there has to be a natural, as you say, friendship, a natural relationship. And then if one is more advanced and the other one is open to it, then they're, you know, teaching going. But it has to be natural at a human level. And it can't be that a guru is just, let's say if I'm doing that service in ISKCON, it can't be that I get so much into the role of it. Like my image of how a guru should walk and talk and what kind of sandals to wear and how to modulate my voice and, you know, and sort of like obsessive etiquette. It can't get to the point where I'm just sort of like, I become an abstraction, the guru, and the disciple becomes an abstraction, the disciple. There has to be a real relationship. I know myself, personally, I can understand very well what Prabhupada says, a Christian is more pleased when someone just treats him as a friend. That, I'm blessed. I have many disciples that are really, I really enjoy their company. And sometimes people maybe don't know me that well, disciples, they come and they're extremely reverential and treat me as if I'm sort of a, you know, everything I say is miraculous and everything I do is totally mystical, and it's kind of annoying. And it's, I feel like saying, could you be a real person? So I don't mean to denigrate those people, but I think there has to be a real human relationship, and if within that real human relationship there's a good teacher-student thing, then it can become a guru disciple relationship.
I think that's where the anger comes from, because if you're made into an abstraction, and even if you're not put down or criticized or belittled, if somehow you're made to feel less than what you actually are, because that's your position, is to be less, not because...
Yeah, that's kind of absurd. Like, I actually can do this, but I should act stupid in front of my guru because that's Vedic culture. I mean, not that we show off. We don't show off, but as a guru, why should I want to push someone down beneath their actual level of ability and maturity? Like, why? It seems like I'm trying to push them up, not push them down. Yes, going back to the male-bodied community, yes.
Yeah.
You mean the guru or the disciple? Well, there's a danger for anyone in a leadership position. You start to see yourself through the eyes of the followers. It can be seductive. You have people, if I have people around me telling me you're great, you're this, you're that, it's like, don't stop. So it can definitely be seductive. And at a certain point you kind of cave in and just, okay, I'm the person you say I am. And then, of course, if that person has difficulties, like, where do they go? Because it's like you almost, there can be a fear, like, oh my God, you know, I'll be torn to pieces by the angry crowd if I... Yeah, so therefore... You can only use a certain amount of cow dung when you're washing his feet and everything. Yeah, well, it's, I think the general principle is that we should be scientific. And I mean, a guru, bona fide gurus are wonderful people, but so are mothers and fathers, and so are, it seems to me that the strategy, you know, if there's a puja gap in ISKCON, It seems to me that there's been kind of some wrong thinking in the sense of let's pull everyone down so that before they fall down, pull them down because you can't fall off the first floor. If you're already, you know, if you're already on the ground, you can't fall very far. It seems to me there should be a general culture of generosity. We should honor mothers, fathers, teachers, gurus. In fact, in the Bhagavatam, that famous verse, Guru Nasasyat, that he should not be a guru, Janani Nasasyat, she should not be a mother, Pita Nasasyat, he should not be a father, and so on, one who cannot liberate their dependents. So the Bhagavatam talks about parents and gurus and public leaders sort of on the same level. And it's like if you live in a country where everyone drives a Mercedes, then it's not really like a big status, just like because everyone drives one. But if you live in a country where only a few people do, then it's a big deal, and so on. So in the same way, if we live in a culture which is in general generous and we honor people, then a guru is also honored, but it's not so seductive because many people are being honored, and of course there's a special honor reserved for the guru. So,
but of course, we need to offer more, you know, more to the higher degree. I mean, the group's just not on an ordinary platform, it's like my mom and dad. We can offer more respect to the spiritual master representing God. But I was just.
True, however, how should I put it? Somehow or other, we need to be generous and respectful without being foolish. So that, and of course familiarity breeds contempt. I mean, there's danger on both sides. I can underestimate a guru. I can think, well, I know this guy. I mean, you know, I've been with this guy for so long, I know. And you can underestimate someone. You can become contemptuous of someone who really is an advanced devotee. So in general, I think of people, and some people are just like cult followers. That's who they are. I mean, there are certain people in ISKCON who psychologically are kind of cult followers. That's what they want, and they sort of lock into that. It may be. Of course, if a guru, if he's actually sober, should want to surround himself with people that they're sort of more sober. And so it also depends on how a guru responds. Like if you sort of surround yourself with obsequious, psychophantic, cult people, then that's very unhealthy.
No, that's your preaching.
Over in the ladies' gallery. Yes?
I was thinking that actually on both sides, if the remembrance is there, that like when Prabhupada, when they made him his first very offering to Vyasa-san, he immediately wanted to offer to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. You know, he didn't feel really worthy of it. So it seems like the point is that, you know, the guru is thinking that, you know, he's offering to his spiritual master. And in one sense, you know, the whole idea of the guru is as good as God is because the guru is representing, that's who he's representing. That's what the Vyasa Sun is telling God. You know, is that correct?
Yeah, so when the guru sits, or if I sit on the seat, or you sit on the seat, if you sit on the seat and you're faithfully, accurately repeating what Krishna said, then your words are as good as God.
It seems like, I know even in my own life, the danger comes in when I think I'm the doer, and everything just goes awry. You know, but as soon as I remember, oh yeah, I'm the servant of Krishna, and he's the one that's in control, then everything kind of evens out. And it just seems like more, we need that humility. Always a humility has to be there.
But a part of the humility is to not, how should I put it, to know what your limits are. So you don't order people in areas of their life where you're really not expert. Or you don't confuse your advice on a practical matter with your absolute position when you're repeating Krishna's words. And so there has to be a certain maturity and sobriety and humility in a person in a position of authority, so they do their job right.
Just one other thing was, you know, in terms of questioning, like in the minds or other people around, if you see something or, you know, that's wrong, and that you feel is wrong, you know, someone's going in the wrong direction, you know, you're hesitant to approach that person. A lot of times it's, you know, the offense, the whole idea of the offense, you know, making an apparat. Yeah, so that's a big thing for a lot of people. They don't know how to, they don't want to transgress. They don't want to offend. So how to see that? How to deal with that? Let's say you see someone, you really think that this person is going, they're going off. They're going in the wrong direction. And you want to approach with humility, but maybe that person will take that.
Do you mean a leader going awry?
Possibly a leader, or, you know, in different levels of leadership. So how, you know, but that's for many years that was very, very worse. It was like the mad elephant offense. I mean, you didn't dare for fear of completely wiping out your garden, you know. So how to see that, how to deal with that particular.
I think it gets back to the same point, having a more realistic, moderate culture where we respect people and honor people, but we keep our own responsibility and integrity. I know.
Well, in relation to that, when we had an etiquette class, they said that if you are in a position to say something to somebody, there is an etiquette that you were describing that's important in these kind of interactions, because somebody has to have faith in you and there has to be a relationship established. But I really like what you were saying about the culture of generosity. I think if anything really is a wonderful theme for where we can go as a society, individually and collectively. I think that's a very, very wonderful umbrella that a lot can go in. I think that many of us have not always appreciated what it means to go through our purification in the eyes of the world, as many people who have taken leadership positions and basically made themselves perfect targets for the material energy have done. You know, I mean, it's easy to have grievances, but, you know, the native people, and it's in every culture, they say walk a mile on somebody else's moccasins or Birkenstocks or whatever. You know, it's not an easy thing, and we do need that culture of generosity. And maybe by demystifying that position and really opening the doors for people who have been faithful followers and are more local, so that there aren't just a few people exhausting themselves physically, emotionally, and spiritually, traveling all over the world trying to satisfy thousands of people with spiritual needs. Is there a possibility that maybe the doors will be open, maybe more in training for those who have had that position, for many people to have it more locally so people could feel more cared for?
I think it's a very good idea. And This topic came up in the GVC meeting. Actually, I brought it up at the GVC meeting. And that is that I think ISKCON, by its success, we now have like 500 projects, almost 100 countries. It's gotten to the point where we really need people whose primary service is thinking about the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And people are working in their different regions. And the reason there's a sense, I think, among many devotees that the GVC as a body is not so relevant is that the individual GVC members, many of whom are actually very good devotees and competent, they spend like 11 and a half months a year in their zones, and then you fly into India and suddenly you have to think of the world, which you haven't thought of all year. And we have an executive committee, but all the members of it have full-time service in their respective areas. So I think he's coming to the point where we need some devotees who are competent, who are good devotees, to actually have as their primary service, perhaps as their exclusive service, really trying to provide international leadership, not over the GVC, but under the GVC. That was Prabhupada's system. Because issues like you brought up, I mean, we just need to have more time. People are so busy nowadays. Everyone's rushing around. The world is so accelerated. And if you think of a boat, the faster a boat goes on the water, the higher it is in the water. So literally like hydroplanes. You know, they have very fast boats that really are above the water. And as the boat goes slower, it begins to sink into the water more and more deeply. So life moves so quickly nowadays that I think that many people, including, unfortunately, many leaders in ISKCON, physiologically, neurologically speaking, can't think that much. Because it's like sometimes if you're in a rush and someone tries to talk to you about something, you say, I can't think about that now, I'm in a rush, I'll talk to you later. So, if you're always in a rush, when does the thinking? So it's a very, I mean, apart from ISKCON, just in the world in general, it's a very thoughtless, shallow world we live in. Everything's going so fast. The faster it goes, the more shallow it is. And I know a lot of ISKCON leaders, sometimes it's hard for me to get quality time with them. So, I mean, I'm not going to give them a donation, really, or be initiated by them, or reinitiated by them. So I think, we need that. I think we need people that really just, we need to have or create a system which allows some leaders to be more thoughtful. So there's really a sense that someone's guiding the international society. Yes? Do we allow youth to speak here? I guess we do.
Sometimes we encounter individuals who are cynical or critical of either the system, the system, or the individuals that are leading ISKCON, whether like was in the past or in the present. And a lot of times, if I'm in that situation, I feel like pulled in different directions. Like emotionally, I might want to defend the system or the individual. Logically, I might want to just detach myself from that person's association just because it's not favorable and it's offensive. And scripturally, I feel obligated to slay them because it says, you know, if they offend the spiritual master. And it's like all these different things. And I really know sometimes people, they speak about the system or individuals in such a way that I want to be able to change that, but don't really know how it is to go about making them favorable again when there might be so much like deeply rooted criticism.
Well, there certainly are problems, and at the same time, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, I think it was Bhaktivinoda said, that there's nothing worse than a stupid critic. So, I mean, sometimes criticism is constructive and intelligent and invaluable, and sometimes it's just irrational. John Adams is the second president of this country, and his record is a little bit tainted by the fact that he pushed through a bill in Congress called the Alien and Sedition Act, which sort of put limits on free speech. The reason was that I think the capital then was in Philadelphia. Or was it Washington?
New York was first.
I'm wondering if for some reason they had to move to Philadelphia for a while. But in any case...
Then Philly.
There was a newspaper owner who was apparently really out of control. He was just publishing all this wild criticism and constantly attacking Adams, and finally kind of snapped and had this alien sedition law passed. But I mean, as far as the GBC, my conclusion, having gone to the meeting for the first time in 12 years, so I don't think I'm like lost in the trees and can't see the forest. My impression is, and having been a GBC under Prabhupada, is that the problem is more systemic than individual. There are many GBC, I mean, some GBC people are a little sort of weak links, you might say. But I think many of them, I think even most of them, are actually very good devotees, and in their individual zones, they do a reasonably good job. In some cases, an excellent job. So it's not that, I mean, often in an individual level, I'd say most of them are sort of doing a reasonably good job. When they get together as a collective body, the lights go out. So I think the reason is systemic, in the sense that the system doesn't really allow them to be competent. What do we do now? Stop? Maybe I'll just finish this sentence and then... So, for example, we're having more GBC meetings. I mean, imagine a big corporation with 500 branches, millions of members in 100 countries, and the people managing the corporation meet once a year for a week. I mean, it's absurd. So now there's a plan to have more meetings, perhaps to have permanent executive. So I think the problem is more systemic. Most of the GBC members are actually good, sincere, overworked people, but the system actually is really not altogether functional. So, thank you very much. Hopefully we'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Here, take this, Padraji.
Thank you.
I hope the person that made it is not disappointed with you.
Thank you.